Okay, good morning. It is Thursday morning, February 18th, 9 a.m. We're doing lab, Chem 12. And I was just discussing with the class what the plan for today is. And so I think the plan for today is to take lab and to utilize the lab time to support the lecture time and to do some problem solving sessions and treat it like an extended sort of office hours and work some more on the synthesis problems. Because today in lecture, I want to jump forward and I want to go into the alcohols and phenols section, which I think is chapter 13. So that's the plan for this afternoon for lecture. So for lab, I thought that we could support and have a little bit more working time with some of these synthesis ones, and maybe a little bit more interactive than just watching me do it. And what I had previously asked everyone to do was to start working on some of the synthesis problems that I had put up in Canvas and to use those as a way of starting to get your questions met, to come in with those questions and how do I do this, or this is what I'm really having trouble with, and use this morning as that sort of problem solving type session. So, and I don't know if anybody did that. So hopefully, and if not, then I will come up with some things to do. Okay. So let me know, did anybody attempt some of those synthesis problems? Have you tried them yet?
I didn't.
Okay. Yeah, I was worried about that. Sometimes best suggestions sometimes don't always happen. I know that we're busy and I know that there's lots of other classes and due dates. And when it's sort of a study thing and it's not a timed, I need to meet this deadline, this quiz is due or this exam is due, then those things kind of fall a little bit behind. So, all right, let me see then if I can figure out what I did with some of those problems problems and pull up some for us to do. So give me one second. My computer, I left last night. I ended my session at like 12:30 in video making and all my video stuff is still up. So it takes me a second to close all that out and get back to where I need to be. Chem 12, fall study problems, synthesis problems. Okay, and let's go ahead and start a screen share. All right, so I think that we did up to problem 5. Let's start problem 6. And number 6 has a 1-butene that you're being asked to convert into, let's see, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This is a 2-hexanone. So that's what we're being asked to do. All right, I'm going to move my windows around just a little bit more so that I can actually see you guys too. Because even just a couple of faces allows me to think and concentrate better, surprisingly, funny enough. All right, what's our first step? What do we want to do in order to get this started? What's the first thing that I've listed out as being sort of an important first step?
Number carbons.
Number the carbons, okay. And I've been putting that under the title of mapping, sort of figuring out what's going where. Absolutely. So, and with this one, it may not be so easy to see because there's no handle. So usually what we do is we look for a handle. And we said that a handle was a way of relating one molecule to another that allowed us to find an orientation. And this one doesn't have that so much. So this one does have two additional carbon units in it. And with those two additional carbon units, I suppose that we could have some options here. So usually when I write these problems out, I have a clean way that I like to write them out that makes it easy to follow. When I'm doing it in a thinking process and trying to show you my thought process, it disrupts that flow that I normally do. So I'm gonna go ahead and disrupt that flow because that's the only way I can teach it, I think. We have options for how to break this down. And we need to decide which of these options is the correct way. So if we get rid of the numbering for a minute and we ignore the numbering, we know that we have two extra carbons. Those two additional carbons can be chunked off with a bond breaking either here or here, so that we pull off one and two. Actually, let's label them five and six, because that's really the new carbons that they are. And so we're either looking at five and six being the new carbons that we add with the carbonyl there, or we're looking at five and six being the new carbons over here. And we need to sort of decide which one of these might be the easier path. So which way do we want to choose in terms of how we break this off? What seems to be a more appropriate choice? So they're both labeled five and six. So Drew, if you can give me an A or B, there we go. Okay, so AJ's got A, Drew's got A, nice. A seems to be better. Now, can you find words to explain why you think A is a better choice than B? If you were going to explain it to one of your colleagues, why would you say that five and six might be easier? That A might be easier, I should say. Anybody want to try?
Easier to eventually tautomerize into that ketone?
Right. Okay. So what I'm seeing here is that A, this seems to be a better choice because it allows us to be able to go back to something that I'm going to be able to mark down now as five and six tautomerize, and I will be able to break that bond. And I know that I can put that bond back together because that's an alkyne. And I know that if I can create just an alkyl halide here, that I could get some sort of bromide and the alkynyl anion, and that'll put that back together. And that's a good bond breakage. And what we're saying is that B, maybe not so good, because if I break that bond, then I'm coming back to some kind of anion here. And at that point, I've got to figure out some sort of cation in this location. And number one, this guy could maybe come from a Grignard. So maybe I could get MgBr. But then this piece, we haven't learned how to deal with or how to do that yet. And so this is a dead end. While both of these pieces, I understand. Does that make sense in terms of making that choice? Okay, so let's run it from that perspective. Let's go ahead then and let's do a retrosynthesis for it. It might fit in here. Let's try this. Okay, so what we're going to do is we said that we're going to go back to the alkyne. We will then go ahead and split the bond. In splitting the bond, we'll take it to an alkynyl anion. And that will be with a sodium cation or lithium, depending on what we deprotonate it with. And that the other piece is going to have a halogen on it. And that halogen, if we look at it, could go all the way back to my starting material. And I can make that halogen directly from that starting material. And I have actually not nearly as bad a synthesis as this originally looked like. This actually goes together pretty darn quickly. So what I need to do in the forwards direction, I'll shrink it down so that we can see where we're starting. We're going to start with the butene, 1-butene. Did I label that 2-butene? That should have been 1. Let's fix it up here too. And from there, we take and we desire to put the halogen out on the terminal end. So what reagent do I need to accomplish that goal?
HBr and peroxide.
Excellent. I'll give you another sequence here. I'll give it an or. We could do BH3THF. And 2, the oxidation, sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water. That would give me the alcohol. And then from the alcohol, I could use tosyl chloride in pyridine to be able to make the tosylate leaving group. And then from those, either of those, because those are both good leaving groups, then I would take my sodium amide. And react it in the SN2 reaction. And then from there, it's H2SO4, water, I forgot the water part, water, H2SO4, and then mercury sulfate. And that'll go through the enol and tautomerize. So I wanted you to see that this option is a good option to keep in mind too. Being able to make a tosylate, make a really good leaving group, is an excellent thing to see how to do. And yes, it takes an additional step, but sometimes we're going into the alcohol chapter and we're going to be dealing with alcohols a lot. And so I want this tosylate idea to be on your mind. Oh, I guess there's a third way that I could say here too, not to overwhelm you, but from alcohols, if you take the alcohol, you can react the alcohol with PBr3. And that replaces the hydroxyl group with a bromide. And so you can still get to the bromide through the alcohol using PBr3. So a number of different ways of creating leaving groups from different starting points. All right. How does that sit okay with everybody? Okay. I'm deciding I had these in sequence. And whether I want to leave them and do them in the same order or switch up orders. This one's number 7. Okay, so with number 7, we're starting with 1-butene again. And if we go through the same exercise, this time we're looking at hexanal, the aldehyde. And if we go through the same exercise, we can split either between the 4-5 bond or between the 1-2 bond, but it looks like we need to split 2 carbons off. So given the position of the aldehyde, it looks like the best place to split is probably between the 4-5 bond. As a planning process. All right, so let's go ahead and do the retrosynthesis. And where does this aldehyde come from? What do I want to go back to? What sort of functional group can I make the aldehyde from? Yeah, go back to the alkyne again between 5 and 6.
Wouldn't this be the same thing, only use 9-BBN instead of then?
It is. And that's the progression, is that that's what I'm trying to get you to see, is the commonality in some of these problems. And just thinking through these problems, that now I'm back at this point. As I split that off, I'm back in having a leaving group here, and my alkynyl anion, and that halogen is simply made from there. And so this looks like the exact same problem. And it is. So if we take this guy and do HBr and peroxide. We then treat it with the acetylide ion. That adds our 2 carbons. We then take and react that with 9-BBN. That's the first step. Second step is sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water. That takes us through an enol. It is a terminal enol. And that tautomerizes to the aldehyde. And so really the only major difference in this was this guy. Except, let me show you something different. What if I do this? Let's go ahead and do H barium peroxide. And then let's react this with a Grignard. Or actually, no, I take it back. I was going to do a Grignard, but let's go ahead and do an alkynyl anion. Let's do this. Except that won't work. I do need to do it as a Grignard. And I need to think about it for a second. Yeah. As a Grignard and as a primary alkyl halide, this is inherently an SN2 reaction. Now remember that Grignards can be made from almost any substrate, that any carbon, the carbon can be sp3, can be sp2, can be sp hybridized. I can make a Grignard from almost any carbon that started out as a halogen bond. And if I react these two together, if we count through and we look at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7, this is going to make a 7-carbon chain. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And the new bond that I created is between 5 and 4. So there's my new bond. And then if I take this and I ask you what the result is of doing this next reaction, I want to do 1 ozonolysis and 2, I want to do a reductive workup of zinc and water. What does ozonolysis do? To an alkene.
Carbonyls.
It makes carbonyl out of it. In fact, what it does is it breaks it in half and it makes 2 carbonyls. And depending upon whether you do reductive or oxidative, just a little aside over here, that if we have 2 R groups and we do ozonolysis and reductive, and that reductive workup most commonly is seen as zinc and water. There is another one. Actually, there's a bunch of them. This will make aldehydes out of the 2 sides. If we take that same thing and we change it from reductive to oxidative, oxidative can be a number of different reagents. Usually they involve hydrogen peroxide. So an oxidative workup usually looks like, sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and then 3, we need to do dilute acid. So there's an oxidative workup, it's usually 3 steps. This makes 2 carbonyls, but they both now come out as carboxylic acids. And so the reductive leads to aldehydes, and the oxidative leads to carboxylic acids. Okay, so what we have done on ours is we've done that reductive workup. And in doing that, we end up with aldehydes. But not just any aldehydes. This little one is formaldehyde. And formaldehyde is a gas and will leave the reaction vessel. And the other one, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, is now the 6-carbon chain, hexanal, that we wanted. And so what this illustrates is the ability to use sometimes a larger organometallic molecule and to throw away a carbon. And throwing away a carbon can be a really interesting way to achieve a molecule. Add more carbons than you need, and then throw some away to be able to achieve the functional group that you desire. So sometimes we think of synthesis as being constructive and always adding, and that's not always the case. Sometimes it can be extremely beneficial to subtract in order to synthesize a molecule, in order to do something creative. And so this idea of being able to go through and use ozonolysis as a way of removing a carbon is a really, really good trick or skill to have in your tool bag of things to do. All right, let's see. This one will give us some practice with synthons. All right, so this problem, when we map it, has a handle in it. The handle that I'm seeing is the isopropyl group. Helps me to see and orient. So that idea of mapping out the number of carbons and visually seeing where things are going becomes easier because of the isopropyl group. So it does look indeed like I'm adding 2 carbons again. Oh, Abby, does this only work if you can create the formaldehyde that will leave as a gas? And the answer is it's advantageous. So Abby, your question is back to here. Does throwing away a carbon only work when you can eliminate it as a gas? And the answer is no. Throwing away a carbon works anytime, but you do have to be able to isolate the two away from each other. And so if you're going to break off a carbon like this, it's advantageous if one of them goes off as a gas, either as carbon dioxide, CO2, or as formaldehyde, however you can swing it. But it is not a necessity because we can go through other extraction processes to separate these two molecules, or chromatography to separate these two molecules, because they're vastly different sizes and they're different polarities. They would be fairly easy to separate. So no, it doesn't always have to be one carbon. It can be, and I'll say that we'll use this trick for more than just throwing away a carbon. Sometimes it's a way of opening a ring in order to take something that is a cyclic starting material and get to a linear product. And then we'll see also there's a reverse way of going from linear products to be able to get to ring systems. So we'll start working in those domains too. And ozonolysis comes back and plays a fairly large role in a lot of that. That's a good question. Okay. The isopropyl group helps us orient. And one of the things that I see is that I have the two additional carbons, and I'm going to need to split those guys off at some point. And so maybe that's not a bad thought to say, all right, let's just take it back. To the synthons. Now, if you've watched sort of as I've been doing these problems, I'm going to scan back for a second. When I did the retrosynthesis before, as I stepped it back, I took it back not to synthons, but to actual molecules. I bypassed the synthon stage. If I were looking for the synthons in this would have been the carbocation and the alkyl anion. These would have been the synthons for which the bromide and the alkynyl anion are the representative molecules for those synthons. And so I didn't take it back to synthons because this step was sufficiently easy for you guys to make this jump. Likewise, back in this problem, first one we did, when I broke it apart, I did the same thing. I didn't take it back to synthons. But the one we're doing now, there we go. It's not clear what this synthon could be. And one of the things that people try to do is they get stuck in a rut. So let's look at possible synthetic equivalents of the synthons. That's what they call them. The synthetic equivalent of the alkynyl anion is just the, acetylide anion. And so acetylide, this one is easy because it just is that. But the other one is not so easy. Many people will take this and say, all right, well, I just need a leaving group here. So maybe this is, I guess this should be a retrosynthesis arrow, because we're really working backwards. Many people will say, well, how about I just put the bromide on there? And I just react that with the bromide. And the problem is that if you take these two and try to react them, do you know what the outcome is? Do you know what happens if you take this anion and react it with this molecule, what the product is that we actually get, or products? You get an acid-base reaction. Because of the acidity of the alcohol. And so you can't get substitution if you have a strong base and an acidic proton in the same molecule that you're trying to react together. They will react in an acid-base manner where the proton will be taken and the electrons given back to the oxygen. And so this is not a viable molecule to try to go back to. So we need to find a different route where I don't have that acidic proton. And one of the things that I think about when I look at this is the realization that this guy is so close that it could easily form the three-membered ring epoxide. And that this is probably far better to consider taking it back to the epoxide as a pattern. And now there's no acidic proton. So now when I go through and react this with the acetylide, now it does the SN2 reaction, knocking this open. So we would have to do one and then two. We would need dilute acid to protonate the alcohol that is going to result. And now we get the substitution. So when we are looking at synthons, the lesson from this is that anytime you have an oxygen in a 1-2 pattern, and this guy could have an H or an R on it, that this synthon can be thought of as being derived from an epoxide. And that this is the synthetic equivalent. In the same way, if we have a desired cation and it is on carbon number one, the same carbon that the oxygen is attached to, and this is our synthon, then that guy can be derived from the carbonyl. And so seeing these pattern recognitions, different synthons. All right, so that was a bunch of information. Let's go back and finish our problem now that we have some of that insight. Okay, so working backwards. We'll go to the synthons. Those synthons are represented by the epoxide. Reacting with the sodium acetylide. And now I've got to work on that epoxide and where that epoxide came from and how do I make an epoxide. So what is the reagent that allows me to make epoxides? And what do I make epoxides from? Where do epoxides come from?
MCBA.
MCPBA. Yeah, exactly. So it's MCPBA. And what is the functional group that MCPBA works on to make the epoxide?
An alkene.
Exactly. So we go back to that alkene. And then that alkene, can that alkene be made from the existing bromide? It can be. So straight shot back to that bromide. Now I need to put this together in the forwards direction. So this was my retro. Now in the forwards direction, I desire to make the alkene. What reagent? LDA. Drew gave it to me. Now when you use LDA, LDA is usually used in ether solvent. So LDA is one of those reagents that it's good to include a solvent system and oftentimes a temperature. And while minus 68 degrees seems really cold, LDA is so reactive that we don't generally use LDA at room temperature. And there are a couple of standard temperatures that are used. I know this is an aside again, I go room temp, 0 degrees C, minus 33 degrees C, and minus 68. There are other easily achievable temperatures, but these are brought about by an ice bath. This one is brought about by liquid ammonia, which auto-cools to minus 33 because that's its boiling point. And minus 68 is a very convenient temperature that we use quite frequently, which is dry ice and acetone. When you mix dry ice and acetone, they equilibrate at minus 68. And it's a very convenient temperature to use for things that are extremely exothermic. And so to control LDA, we will oftentimes do this at minus 68 degrees in dry ice and acetone as a cooling bath. I figure we're in lab, so I'm giving you some lab information too. You're getting everything at once. All right, next up. I got to make the epoxide. That was already given to me. So that was Keegan who provided us with the MCPBA. And my preference for that is that MCPBA is the reagent of choice to be able to make epoxides. It is metachloroperoxybenzoic acid. And so the M is usually a small M and italicized, standing for meta. Metachloro Paroxy, benzoic acid. And say they pull the MCPBA out of that. And so you'll oftentimes see it abbreviated with a lowercase m, capital MCPBA, but you'll just as frequently see it with a capital M. So if you're wondering where those initials come from or why sometimes you'll see people write it with a lowercase m, it's because the meta is an italicized lowercase m to represent the meta position in that. And it's just a very, very common reagent. Okay, next step, we bring in one, the sodium acetylide. And then two, we need dilute acid. If we don't do the dilute acid step, I'll draw it and show you what happens. Without dilute acid, you get locked into the oxyanion and the sodium counterion. And so the proton source, the reason for the dilute acid is to protonate the alkoxide to give us the alcohol. So without that, it's kind of incorrect, or at least it has some issues there. Now look at what we've done. We've created a molecule that has an alkyne in it that we can do other things with. So with that alcohol or with that alkyne there, I could give you some new synthesis problems that, watch. I don't know if I have them on the sheet. I do not, but this is an excellent watch. You now know how to take this material and make things like this. Or this. And you can make either of those materials. Yeah, exactly. We're learning new things. Keegan is saying our tool chest is we're getting more tools in the trunk, more things that we can do. Because now that we can access that alkyne in the position where it's at and the hydroxyl group, I can convert that alkyne into the different things that I would have done with an alkyne normally. So I can make all of these things, or I could, from that alkyne, think about all the things you can do with an alkyne. Or I can make it into that. Because all I have to do is reduce the alkyne down to an alkene. And you can see how all of a sudden, before taking this to something like this, your brain would have gone, that's not cool. That pattern recognition wasn't there yet. But once we see, oh, this idea of reacting the epoxide with an alkyl anion to be able to open it up to see this pattern. So what is this pattern? What are we looking at? Okay, well, let's look and see. It's splitting it here. It's splitting it here. And it is splitting it. Actually, I think I put one too many carbons on this last one. Would have been going back to this. And it's splitting it here. All of them splitting in the same spot. One, two, three, four, five, six. One, two, three, four, five, six. All splitting between four and five. And the reason that we're splitting it between four and five is because all of these in a retrosynthesis sense go back to the same pattern. That give me, oops, that should have been an anion. No, I circled it twice. Cascade failure. And so all of these can be thought of as being derived from that group. And on the other side, derived from the epoxide. Is that making sense? Okay. Let's see where to go next. Okay, let's see how well you all retained pattern recognition. This is number 11. So first steps, what do? The handle on this one really is the ring system. And if we're counting carbons, we lost a carbon. So there's one less carbon in this molecule than in the starting material. So what can I take this back to in a retrosynthesis concept? What molecule could this cyclopentanone have come from? Use O, O3. Yes, O3. Ozonolysis could have done it. So if you're thinking ozonolysis, then you're most likely thinking thinking of going back to this guy without the oxygen, where number six was there. And this is what's called a functional group interconversion. Oftentimes we just say, or functional group transformation, let's do it that. Let's call it transformation, FGT. So I'm swapping the ketone for an alkene because I know I can convert the alkene back into the ketone using ozonolysis. But how do I get the double bond from its current location to the location that I need? So I need to step this back to some other intermediate molecule that takes me back to before this guy. So where do double bonds come from? BR3 at the tertiary position, that will work. That is one option. There are other options, of course. We could take it back to the chloride. We could take it back to a tosylate. We could take it back to any number of different molecules. And from this point, it's fairly conceivable to see that that tertiary bromide could come from the double bond. And I could think of at least two ways to be able to get there, or three ways to be able to get there. So let's try that much and try taking that in a forward direction. By the way, I would say that these are still viable problems to go back and practice, because even after you set down your notes, to go back and do these is going to require some concentration. And just because you've seen them doesn't always make them easy when you're going back and you're restarting the whole set again. So these are still good, viable practice. Let's take this guy and give me the reagent to make that tertiary bromide. So just straight up HBr. HBr will give me the more stable carbocation at the tertiary position, and the bromide will add to that tertiary position in that way. Now what I've got to do is I've got to accomplish the elimination, but I want it to be regioselective to eliminate out at the primary carbon. So what base do I want to use, a large base or a small base? Drew, sodium ethoxide. If I take this and react this with sodium ethoxide, it's going to take me back to that material because this is a small base. And the small base is going to do E2, but it's going to go for the more substituted E2. So we've got to go, yeah, Drew, that's better, LDATHF. This is either LDATHF, or you could use the potassium tert butoxide, but it's got to be the bulky base. And that one is usually done in tertiary butanol. And so this needs to be the bulky base. And this is critical. So yeah, it needs to be a bass. Really got to watch because the sort of standard go-to is to go to something like sodium ethoxide or sodium methoxide. But then you got to think about the fact that there are the two different positions, the more substituted, and this is thermodynamic. This is kinetic. But in these pushing for this substitution, we can make this major. It's hard to control it just by heat alone. It's much better if you control it by sterics, by using a base that will only be able to access those primary protons, as opposed to trying to get in to, so the way that we look at this is these guys out here, the bulky base, can reach into here without much sterics. But if it tries to get into these guys, which are secondary, as opposed to these, which are primary, trying to get in over here, it's met with sterics, which is why it selects out for that primary. And if you go for a small base, then a small base is easily getting in here and will just make your thermodynamic product. So there, that's that difference. Okay, once we have the double bond, now I want to make this guy. And so this is one ozonolysis and two, because we're making a ketone and there's no possibility of making a carboxylic acid, this could be oxidative or reductive. They would both give the same product. And we arrive at the same spot. All right, any questions coming up? Let's see what I've got next for you. Ten is good. Ten has some good considerations. Some of these I use because I want certain pattern recognitions that we will then work around sort of in the middle of a problem. And so I make these problems intentionally smaller with the idea that we could take these ideas and expand them and make them bigger. And do some new interesting things. So this is an interesting problem. And the handle in this one is easy. We've got the ring system here. And we could even map out the number of carbons that are there. Sometimes I'll use color instead of numbering. Instead of numbering the entire ring, because we're using the ring as a handle, sometimes it's easier just to not number the ring and to go and start numbering the linear chain component. So we added one new carbon. is all that's been added to this molecule. And because of that, we're going to break it between 2 and 3 is the logical place to break it. And as we go through and break that there, let's look at the synthons for that. And then we'll take them back to synthetic equivalents. This would be the two synthons. There's two other synthons that we could draw, but we don't have the chemistry yet to handle that consideration. So I'm just going to go with this consideration first. When we see this synthon and I'll leave an R group out there. This is a synthon that relates to the alkynyl anion because of our ability to take an alkyne and to produce a carbonyl out of it. And so the synthetic equivalence of these is to be able to take this back to the alkyne and the other one, perhaps the bromine. And that alkynyl anion, I think that we could see fairly easily that just through elimination, we could take that back to the starting material. The teardown of this is not hard. What's hard is the putting back together of this. Let's take a look at the forward, and I'll show you what I mean. There's a consideration that oftentimes gets lost. Sometimes you don't realize that you need to make the decision. It seems obvious. Let's do 1 sodium azide and 2 sodium amide, excuse me, and 2 methyl bromide. So we will both make the alkynyl anion and react it to put the methyl group on at the same time. Okay, so now we've got the number of carbons. This was 1 and 2 and 3, 1, 2, and 3. So we have added in the carbon, and now we desire a reagent that is going to allow us to be able to put the carbonyl on carbon number 2. And this is the part that I'm curious. How do we get the carbonyl on number 2? What reagent do we use? Nine BBN because of sterics. Yes, if we went, let's look at 2 different reactions. This just gives me a moment to be able to talk about electronics and sterics. If we take this and we react it with water, acid, and mercury 2 sulfate, when it protonates, it's going to protonate in the way that is going to give me this guy because of all the resonance. And because of that, as I follow through that mechanism, when I come to my conclusion of that mechanism, it will give me the carbonyl in that location with just water because of the stability and the prominence of that carbocation. If, however, I take it, I guess I didn't leave myself enough room. So let's move this over to the side. If I take it and I do 9-BBN, 9-BBN works on sterics, not so much electronics. And so what the 9-BBN is going to do is it's going to orient the boron out this way. And it does so because these two groups are the two big steric bulky groups, and they need to go away from each other. We need to make sure that those two groups are pointing in the same direction. So that, as it adds, adds in a syn addition in that way, the oxidation of which provides the enol, and the enol tautomerizes. To give the correct ketone. The correct substitution pattern. So this is indeed 1,9-BBN. And 2, sodium hydroxide, hydrogen peroxide, and water. And by the way, most often 9-BBN is not the reagent of choice for this. I know that we've been saying 9-BBN, but that's because I haven't wanted to introduce another carbon molecule and or another hydroborating reagent, of which there are many. There is this one. Which is very similar to 9-BBN. And this one is I think it's called difexyl borane. I'll have to look back at the name for it. This is what is used more commonly than 9-BBN. And it has more sterics than 9-BBN does, and only hydroborates once. And it's a very common reagent to use. Anyway, I thought I would just show that really quickly. So yeah, lots of good problems here. All right, let's go big. Let's go for number 16. Let's see what happens with this. This is where I think that it starts to get fun. You're going, what is your idea of fun? Okay, first thing, find the handle. What's the handle? What's going to allow me to orient? Sometimes I'm mean. Sometimes I don't give you a handle. Sometimes I turn things around. But oftentimes on the more challenging problems, I will give you a handle to help you to try to find direction. So where's the handle? Okay, so you guys aren't used to me yet entirely. It's been a couple of weeks now, but first semester, I play in lecture a very, it's not a mean game, but there's things that I do first semester that gets people used to me, that oftentimes when I'm presenting material, I bait for the wrong answer all the time. I give you all the information and I leave out certain details that are really important because I really want you to remember those details. And I ask you for the answer. And OCHEM, you guys all come in as sort of like unicorn students. You're just A students. You're pumped. You're ready to go. You're ready to answer questions because you've been on top of it through Chem 1A and Chem 1B. And you throw out that answer with confidence. And I'm like, that's a great answer. No, that's not right. Sorry. And I do it all the time. And I celebrate those wrong answers because wrong answers are just as important as right answers, because wrong answers mean that you're paying attention and you're following. It's just, I haven't taught you what I want to teach you yet. And I'm about to use it as a teaching moment. And so I celebrate wrong answers just as much as I celebrate right answers. It means that you're participating and you're engaged and you're willing to try. Don't be afraid to try. A wrong answer is not a death sentence it tells me that you're participating. And you're doing exactly what I want you to do. Okay. The oxygen and the methyl group are both handles and are both appropriate places to look. Yeah, I would cite the methyl group, but then of course the oxygen that is attached to it is also an excellent place in order to grab the handle. And so in this one, as I go 1, 2, and then the oxygen, I'm 1, 2, and the oxygen, and that means that this carbon out here that I'm going to label 3 has to be attached to number 2. This guy here has to be number 3. And so finding that handle really helps with the numbering. So we'll grab that. And that's where the original molecule resides in this. That means that there are 2 new bonds that I'm going to have to create. And some sort of cyclization. That needs to happen. Okay, so what do I attack first? I'm going to say that in a retro sense, this is going to be first made. This is going to be the second made. But when I go backwards, I'm going backwards this way. I'm going back to number 2. And then at some point, I'm going back to number 1. And so I have to deal with this piece first, if that makes sense. When I disconnect the first thing, I'm going to do it from synthons. So I'm going to open it up. I'm going to leave it, actually, in pretty close to the same orientation that I have it now. I broke that bond. This is a synthon. It's not an actual molecule. I need to figure out some way of putting this bond back together and having some group here that could be a leaving group. So I need a synthetic equivalent of this synthon. all the leaving groups that we have dealt with so far are perfectly appropriate. So I could take it back to this guy. Where did this guy come from? And maybe I don't need to do this intermediate hydrogen or anion. Maybe I could think of this as being made from that alcohol and that bromide. And then now I've got to start being worried about going back to this carbon and breaking off this carbon. So let's number these out fully so that we can keep track. 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Numbering is the best possible thing you can do. All right. I'm desiring to break this off between 3 and 4. To break it off between 3 and 4, I need to think about what that's going to do as a synthon in a way of breaking this bond. And there's a couple of intermediary steps in here that make this hard to visualize. So let's do it this way. Let me show you the pattern and what it is I desire to do. I want to take this back to, at first, a double bond. And then from the double bond, I desire to take it back to the triple bond. And from the triple bond, now I can see, except I did it in that gets me in the right spot. Except I'm breaking the bond in the wrong spot. It's this bond I gotta break. That's why my brain chunked. There we go. That's why numbering 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. See, even I make mistakes when I don't number. So numbering is really critical. Once I take that off, now I can see this going back to the epoxide. And it was this idea of being able to break the bond between 3 and 4, and that idea of the synthon coming from that epoxide. And so what I needed to be able to see is I needed to be able to see that this bromide, when I break between 3 and 4, this leads me to 2 synthons. If I just break this without doing any bond conversions or functional group conversions with the bromide, I get back to this. And I have to see this for being the synthon for the epoxide and the synthon for the 2-carbon alkyne. And sometimes that's a large leap to be able to see that you can do that. But if I do it stepwise and I say, all right, the bromide came from the double bond, the double bond came from the triple bond. The triple bond then was added to the epoxide. It makes an easier sequence to see. Am I making that clear enough? All right, let's take it forward. In the forwards direction. Let's see what we need to do. You take the epoxide. We react it. With the sodium acetylene. We do that. And then we hit it with some dilute acid. Why do I write dilute acid rather than writing H3O plus or HCl or H2SO4? What's the distinction between these guys? The difference between these? I make a distinction that when I use dilute acid and I say dilute H plus, this is equal to something like 1 or 2 molar HCl. It is not strong enough to protonate oxygens and rip them off and cause formation of carbocations or elimination reactions or other types of things. This is really just for protonation. It is weak, mild conditions. So I use it when I want to protonate something and I don't want to blow up other functional groups. The difference between that and this idea of H3O plus or HCl or H2SO4, oftentimes these are followed with concentrated. So these are strong acid conditions. These are conditions that will protonate double bonds, creating carbocations. These are conditions that will take alcohols and kick them off, creating the carbocations. And isn't H plus H3O plus, isn't it the same thing? Yes, sometimes you'll see people and they'll say just dilute H plus, but really the key word here, the word that we're keying in on is dilute. So when you see dilute in front of something, dilute H plus or dilute H3O plus, it's the distinction between that and concentrated that really makes the difference. Okay, so this gives us a new bond and the additional 2 carbons. Now I need to get that into double bond form. So what reagent allows me to be able to reduce that down to the alkene? Two reagents can do this. One is probably better than the other in this case. H2 and Linlar is good. Good. Yeah, you guys are jumping in. Okay, Kelly, reducing metals. Let me talk about that one for a second. H2 and Linlar is probably preferred. Reducing metals is sodium and NH3. The only issue that I have with this is that the sodium will deprotonate the proton and leave you with an O minus. And that could cause some competing side reactions because you're creating a strong nucleophile. And so this is extremely basic and may present some issues. I would let it go in this case because there's no other functional groups that O minus might really react with. But that would be my only concern there, is that watching it when you have acidic protons in strongly basic conditions, that you can get some cross reactions. Okay, the next thing that I want to do is I want to put in that bromide into that position. And maybe the bromide isn't the perfect reagent here. So I'm going to give you an option besides the bromide, but go ahead and tell me what we would do normally. And I'll tell you why it might be a problem. So how would I normally get the bromide out there? H-barium peroxide, good, Drew. Okay, HBr, strong acid. For the same reason that I said down here, H2SO4 could cause an oxygen to leave. We could get protonation of the hydroxyl group and loss of that hydroxyl group if we protonated it with the HBr and peroxide. So HBr and peroxide will certainly work. Let's just go with it right now, and then I'll give you an alternative. I'll come back and I'll give you an alternative to this reaction. And then this step is not in our vocabulary yet. This is an SN2 reaction. And in that SN2 reaction, I want the oxygen to be a nucleophile. I want a negative charge on this. So I want something that is going to deprotonate this that is a non-nucleophilic base. There are many non-nucleophilic bases. So we're going to say need a non-nucleophilic base. Non-nucleophilic bases. Sodium hydride is often used as a non-nucleophilic base. It's a great choice. And in fact, it's probably what I would use here. It's just sodium hydride. It pulls the proton, and when it pulls the proton, it makes hydrogen gas, and the hydrogen gas just leaves the vessel. So there's nothing that you have to isolate away from. So I love this one because of its simplicity. But others that you will see quite frequently are diisopropyl amide. So this is our LDA. Hunnings base, which is diisopropyl ethylamine. This one doesn't have abbreviations, and I can't spell the name. You oftentimes see it as Hunnings base. Okay, I need to check the spelling on that. We'll find it later. There are other ones that are pyridine and pyrrolidine. All of these bases are fairly non-nucleophilic because of their sterics. And any one of these bases would effectively pull that proton and allow the internal SN2 reaction to go. And so basically what we're doing is base pulls proton, electrons go back to the oxygen, we create the O minus, I lost a carbon, and then that performs the SN2 reaction that makes the product. We're going to cover reactions like this, SN2 reactions with oxygens, in more detail this afternoon as we get into lecture and we start this alcohol and phenol chapter. But that's a great sort of aside and allowed me to introduce some other ideas and some other bases and things that we can use. Okay. All right, I feel like I've done a ton of stuff. It's 10:40. We've been going for an hour and 40 minutes. And I'm sure you guys could use a break. I could use a break. I feel like I've covered pretty much everything that I want to cover, but how about any questions, you guys? Is anything coming up as we're going through these, or just processing, letting it sink in, taking some time with it?
It's really good practice.
Good. Okay. As long as this is working for you guys. And like I said, I don't like to waste your time. And so rather than filling up lab with some stuff that may not stick so well, if we can steal a little bit and use it for lecture, then it's all good. All right, let's cut the recording. I'll stay on the line if anybody wants to hang out and ask some more questions.